From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. This week, we'll hear from writer Scott Alexander. Best known for his work writing unusual biopics with larger-than-life characters, Alexander ventured into television in 2016 when he co-created FX's award-winning miniseries, The People vs. O.J. Simpson.
There was a time when we lived lives, and everyone else's private life wasn't on screens at all times. O.J. Mania really invented reality television.
Later, television creator, showrunner, and producer Courtney Kemp. Kemp is the mind behind the critically acclaimed gritty New York drama Power, whose fifth season will premiere this summer on the Starz network.
And he, like most black people, thought that he could never be president, that the only way that he was going to get out of the hood was to sell drugs.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry-standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Scott Alexander is best known for co-writing unusual biopics with larger-than-life characters. His films have depicted the lives of filmmaker Ed Wood, comedian Andy Kaufman, and provocateur Larry Flint. In 2016, Alexander co-created The People vs. O.J. Simpson, which was his first foray into television. The miniseries earned numerous awards, including a Golden Globe for Best Miniseries and a Primetime Emmy for Outstanding Limited Series. Journalist R.B. Brenner spoke with Scott Alexander at the 24th Austin Film Festival in 2017. Clips of The People vs. O.J. Simpson, courtesy of Blue Blush Productions, LLC, 20th Century Fox Films Corporation.
So I wanted to start, Scott, with the why question. The murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman were in 1994. The series was 10 weeks in 2016, and I believe you guys were working on it for about 3 years before. So talk a little bit about why you and your creative partner wanted to do it at that point and how you thought about who your audience would be.
We sort of fell into this on kind of a bit of a dare in that we're feature guys. We'd never done TV before, and we had just switched agents, and we were sort of told that you have to take a TV agent as part of the deal if you have a feature agent. It's like, okay, well, we're never going to do TV, so it doesn't matter, but sure. 3 days later, he calls up, and he says, Brad Simpson and Nina Jacobson, and they have the rights to Jeff Toobin's book, People vs. O.J. Simpson, and they want to do it as a miniseries. And Larry and I have spent 30 years saying no to everything that gets offered to us, and we looked at each other, and we said, okay, we'll do it. And we just instantly recognized that the huge tapestry was really cool. So someone of our age, when you say O.J., you just immediately think of the Bronco and Shapiro and Marcia Clark and the Goldmans and Darden. And it was just like all this stuff and the glove and Furman. And there was so much that happened. It merged fully formed. We like hung up the phone and we said, it's all about like, you know, race in America and the LAPD's history with blacks in LA, the invention of the 24-hour news cycle. And it's about the invention of reality TV. And it's about gender politics and how Marcia Clark got mistreated. And it's going to be about how OJ got a better deal because he's a famous person and famous people get treated easier. And it's just like, there was like all this stuff and we just like saw it fully formed. We read Toobin's book, and since then we've become buddies with him, and I love his writing. Jeff loves the weird detail, and what he has in common with me and Larry is he loves eccentric information that tells you about character. That's what I live for. The weird detail that then tells you something interesting about the person that you wouldn't have thought otherwise. Jeff also is very serious about getting it right, but he has a strong opinion, and he has an ironic, funny opinion, and so we share that. What was the question?
It was the why.
Okay, the why was enough time has passed. right after OJ, there were a couple quickie TV movies, and they were cheese ball. No one cared. It was approaching 20 years. We started in 2013. We felt that there was enough perspective. A lot of times people pitch us things that are in the midst. I mean, I can't tell you how many times in the last year we got phone calls, you guys have to do Trump. Or, you know, during the election, you got to do the election. It's just like, I'm not going to do a story that I don't know how the story ends. You need to have perspective. And for us, all the biopics have very strong points of view. And all the biopics are about something more than the log line. 20 years sort of allowed us to kind of take a big picture of it. Both of us have kids in our early 20s, and we used them as sounding boards a lot while we were, because it took us a year just to plot out the 10-hour Bible, and quickly realized that all our kids knew about OJ was he's that fat guy in Nevada who eats oatmeal cookies. And he's always kind of scowling. And thank you. The OJ I grew up with, he was the greatest, man. I would think of him like, you know, like Muhammad Ali and Joe Namath. And he was just like this charismatic. Believe it or not, I grew up in Brentwood. So I saw him a couple times when I was a kid, and he was always nice. He was like the ideal celebrity. Our kids don't know any of that, and they don't know about the Bronco chase, and they don't know anything. And so we knew we were writing for two audiences. We're writing for the audience that had seen Court TV 20 years ago and thought they were bored by the whole thing. And for that audience, we had to make it interesting for them again, and we had to recontextualize it. And then for millennials, we wanted just to draw them in as just a great piece of story, just like, you won't believe this crazy shit that went down. After the fact, we added an opening scene of Cuba getting into the limousine as a celebrity. Because we weren't showing the killings, we wanted to see OJ, as Tubin says in his book, being OJ, just being charismatic and likable. He's endearing. Mm-hmm. And we had to establish that because that's what carried a lot of the trial, which was people couldn't believe, oh, my God, how could OJ have done this? Mm-hmm. You know, they'd be like, what do you mean Justin Timberlake killed someone? And it's like, it's somebody that everyone liked. It was important to explain that to young people.
I would imagine that it's a double-edged sword in terms of you have all of these great themes, all of these really potentially compelling characters, and you have a plot to cover. But I would think the flip side is it's a challenge to try to figure out how do you balance, even over 10 hours, theme, character, and plot. So can you talk a little bit about your writing process?
We went into it thinking it was a 10-hour movie. I mean, also, the 10 hours was decided by us. I mean, FX was amazing. FX gave us total leeway. And to back up, we sold it to Fox. It actually started as a big Fox miniseries. And Fox had a special events division, and the special events division's studio was FX Productions. So FX Productions was making the show for Big Fox, and then at some point while we were writing it, the special events division like went out of business. And then by that point, we had written our pilot, and John Landgraf, who runs FX, had read our pilot, and he was like, ooh, this is cool. And he basically kind of swiped it for his own network. Larry and I came up with an idea because we had never written TV before, so nobody knew what we were doing. So we made up our own rules, and we decided that each hour was going to have its own high concept, a big idea. Some of them were big plot ideas. Some of them were big theme ideas. I'm told that most TV writers don't think this way, but it sort of became like, you know, there's the Marsha episode, there's the Bronco episode, there's the race card episode, the juror episode. You know, each episode had a big idea, which actually ended up working out really well in terms of sort of like focusing our information, and then certainly for the viewers, we had kind of like focused this all these sprawling events. We tried to be really, really factual in terms of the telling of the chronology. But if there were just certain little fun factoids that lent themselves to some of our theme of the week, you know, we would move the factoids, you know, into that week's episode.
Talk about the source material.
We did not meet any of the participants when we wrote the show. And we joke we didn't need to because everyone had written five books. So you don't really need to meet Bob Shapiro or Marsha Clark or the Goldmans. We did an Amazon search, and I think there were 170 books about the trial. I mean, it was crazy. We had about 50 of the books in our office. So we read a lot of these books. And to just to really get everyone's point of view in terms of, you know, what Bob Shapiro was going through, you know, what Darden was going through. I mean, they all express themselves in their books. But Toobin set the tone.
Yeah, what have you got?
Got two victims in Brentwood.
Brentwood? Nobody gets killed in Brentwood.
All right.
You're going to say this case is all about race?
Yes, because it is.
Do you think he did it?
She was terrified of him.
I'm not a public personality. I don't know how to do this.
He's my friend. I don't turn my back on people.
You're turning your back on Nicole.
Who the hell signs a suicide note with a happy face?
I ain't trying to be respectful. I'm trying to win.
The job is to try to get it right, even though you weren't there. It's been 4 years since I read Jeff's book, but I believe his introductory paragraph of Marsha, it was like a string of descriptions, but it was, I remember one of them was quick to judge, profanely funny, and deeply caring. I like this woman. Like, she's really snappy, and she would swear a lot, but she really gave a and she really cared about victims, and she really felt that the victims just don't get a fair shake. And she started really identifying with Nicole and just wanting justice for her. And then you start reading Marsha's book, and then you're getting all the in and outs of the divorce, which that she had filed for divorce, you know, 4 days before the murders. Once you know that, it suddenly spins his character in a completely different way.
All right, it's 3:10 now. I think we're going to be going late tonight.
Your Honor,
I cannot go late tonight.
May I ask why not?
I have to take care of my kids.
Your Honor, are we really going to risk losing this witness because of a babysitting problem?
And then you read Darden's book, and then Darden talks about how when the case broke, he was about to submit his resignation because he was so fed up with the DA's office. He was miserable there. He had a daughter back in the Bay Area. He would drive back and forth to see his family, and he was just sick of it. And whatever dreams he had were long gone. And he was just this Charlie Brown sad character. So once you sort of know that's how each one of them was sort of feeling about the world and about their lives. Then you put them into scenes. You can just kind of put yourself in their minds. We have a list of like facts we have to hit inside that scene, and then you're just trying to kind of hit those facts while keeping them both in character. What was great was the characters. You know, were really complex. Even somebody, you know, as glib as Shapiro, who starts off as this very comical figure, what became clear from all the books was, you know, was that he invented the race car defense, and then Bob really came to regret it.
Now they're going to ask him if he made a racial slur or repeated a racial epithet. But why ask? And there's no legal purpose for it. But Mr. Cochran and the defense have a purpose for entering this area. And that purpose is to inflame the passions of the jury and ask them to pick sides.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. Listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with the People vs. O.J. Simpson co-creator, Scott Alexander. Alexander also co-wrote the films Ed Wood, The People vs. Larry Flint, and Man on the Moon. When we left off, Alexander was discussing how he tackled one of the most notorious American crime stories.
When the O.J. trial went on, the name Kardashian was, you know, completely not what it is today. And, you know, Robert Kardashian was sort of this guy you remembered with sort of the skunk-like streak in the hair and being sort of loyal, O.J.'s sort of loyal friend in the back. In the series, he really has a pretty prominent role. Your thinking would presume that it was to take advantage of the sort of celebrity of the Kardashians, but I know in talking there was another reason that you felt like he was an important character.
That was actually where we deviated from Tubin. Jeff was very snide towards Kardashian. He called him the water boy because he actually was the water boy when OJ was on the football team because they went to SC together. We started looking at Robert as the only selfless character on the show. Everyone else is really, really driven. When we sold the show and we did a pitch, and our pitch was all of like 8 minutes long because we had very little, we said, who's the show about? It's about OJ, right? We go, no, it's not about OJ. It's about Marsha, Chris, and Johnny. Well, why is it about them? Because they're the three characters who care. They're the three characters with passion. All of my biopics are about characters who are crazy passionate about what they're doing. Kardashian was just there out of loyalty to his buddy because they had been friends since college, both still married. The two couples would socialize all the time. He looked OJ in the eye and said, did you do it? And OJ said, no. And he said, okay. And Kardashian was very religious, very soft-spoken, and he sort of was there to the end. There's a famous clip from the trial. You can watch it on YouTube, which is the verdict. Kardashian standing to OJ's left, and when the verdict is read, OJ does that, and Johnny pats OJ's, and Kardashian's face drops. And so we basically made his entire character arc build to that moment we'd seen on YouTube, which is that he stuck with him to the end, and then at a certain point, really after the DNA evidence came out, he realized OJ did it. And he kind of probably knew the whole time, but he was denying it to himself. And after the DNA evidence, everyone kind of turned on OJ. But Robert stuck it out to the end, you know, and then after Robert got cancer and he was in the hospital and dying, and OJ called saying, can I come visit? And he said no. So he never saw him again. And then we had the incredible cosmic gift of the Kardashian name. OJ Mania really invented reality television. There was a time when we lived lives and everyone else's private life wasn't on screens at all times. And the moment really happened where Shapiro did the press conference, and Shapiro was a pro. Shapiro and Bailey and Johnny, these guys were TV pros. They're on TV all the time. And then he kind of pushed Kardashian on stage to do the initial press conference. And this moment was in Jeff's book, and we're like, oh my God, this is gold. He introduced Kardashian, and a reporter asked him to spell his name because no one had ever heard this crazy Armenian name before. And we said, we can turn this into the moment that invented it. And we'll cut to the kids watching TV. And what would that have meant to little 12-year-old Kimmy Kardashian sitting there? And then her dad is spelling the name, and we have them go K-A-R-D-A-S-N. And the kids are H-I-A-N. And they're getting all excited. We're like, they're seeing their dad become someone important. How would that affect you as a kid?
So let's talk about race from a few different perspectives. The first one is the series begins not with the murders or not with something from trying to bring to light OJ's personality. Instead, it begins with the actual archival footage of the Rodney King beating. So talk about that decision.
That was a big deal. And that was our pitch. Our pitch was under 10 minutes. We had nothing. We're going to hit this list of themes I mentioned. Here are the three stars, and we're opening with Rodney King. And the executive, she looked at us, she goes, why are you doing that? It's not even the same year? Like, I don't understand. We go, because that informs what the whole show is going to be about. That's going to contextualize the entire trial, and it's also going to help contextualize it for young people who weren't there. And over the next year was when we started having like all of these beatings of Black Americans. There was the Trayvon Martin case, and there was Eric Garner, and there were so many. It started sort of feeling like we were writing something that was happening today. We had some interesting conversations with FX sort of saying, you're not writing a period piece, guys. You're writing a show about America today. Make it feel like it's the world we're living in. My take on Johnny, and this was watching the trial, you know, back in 94, was I thought he was a strutting peacock and a bit of a showboat. And there was, I remember, the Seinfeld version of Johnny. Seinfeld was a TV show back in the 90s. For you young people, there was a comedian named Jerry. Okay. our plan in terms of the arc was that Johnny is the peacock. He's the showman for 4 or 5, 6 episodes. And then you start to see how genuine he is. And then you learn that he's been doing these civil rights cases for 30 years. There's numerous cases of blacks in L.A. who were beat up, shot, harmed by the LAPD, and they would try to handle it through the criminal courts, and then they wouldn't get anywhere, and then they would always end up in civil court. This was our original intention, was a viewer would see Johnny one way at the beginning of the series and by the end go, oh, wow, okay, he's really genuine, and sort of see the beating heart of Johnny Cochran. And then we started getting like TV instruction lessons from some of the executives. One of them was, you got to meet all your stars in episode one. We're like, what? And then we found out that there was a case that John had been working on and that he and Chris actually knew each other. So we basically took all this information that we had planned on waiting 4 or 5 episodes on and putting it into night one. We have Rodney King, we have The Rise, and then we have Johnny say, this is the problem we have in our society right now, and just announce that. And so the audience goes, okay, that's what the show's about.
So for me, and I remember so much of the trials, but to me, the single thing that stood out all these years, and you show it in the actual footage, is the shots of how people who were white watching on like TV screens reacted versus people who were African American.
The numbers were just categorically, in 95, all the whites said he did it, all the blacks said he didn't do it, or somewhere around like 80-90%. And then the numbers had dropped over the time because OJ's likability factor had dropped. But because we knew there's a certain amount of people who believe in OJ's innocence, we didn't want to push them away. We didn't want to say OJ did it. We wanted to indicate it extremely strongly, as opposed to Jeff in his book. He just says on page one, of course he did it. What we thought was interesting was to present all of the evidence, and the evidence is overwhelming. There's one glove at Bundy. There's one glove on Rockingham. Her blood is at his house. His blood is at her house. They found all that the first night. So we wanted to present all this evidence, which is overwhelming, and have a bunch of completely professional policemen just show up and just do their job. But then we wanted to create doubt down the road. So it plays out the way it played out for the American public and for the prosecution team.
Knowing that race defines in many ways how we, and race and class and other things, how we view the world, how important was sort of having diversity in the creative team?
6 of our 10 episodes were directed by black directors. And then one of them became one of the other like co-EPs of the show.
When Effley Bailey is going to confront Furman on the N-word, and you use the word quite extensively, or at least several times.
I was terrified. I've never used the N-word in my life, and I didn't understand how we were going to say this word in the writer's room, how we were going to say it in the script. And then at a certain point, we just realized how baked into the material was. I think it shows up like 37 times in episode 9. Episode 9 is my favorite episode. That's the Furman episode.
Star-studded cast here.
Amazing cast. I mean, Travolta was the big get because John hadn't done TV since Welcome Back, Cotter. So I think close to 40 years. Getting John was a big deal. Sarah is Ryan's, you know, superstar. And so Sarah was the obvious Marsha. Schwimmer was my idea. I was obsessed with Schwimmer because a friend of mine 20 years ago had written a play that was done in a little 99-seat theater. I'd actually never seen Friends. But I'd seen Schwimmer do this play in this like tiny little room, and he was amazing, and I just loved him. And he had just kind of this sad face. And he just like, and it's like he's got like just so much feeling. And he kind of reminded me of the Kardashian that we were creating for the show. And I was just obsessed with getting David. And David just doesn't work that much. Casting, Darden was the nightmare. This was sort of like a good production story. When they do casting, they do sides. And so they'll pull out a few pages from the script, and that's what the casting director is given. And then the biggest piece of sides was a big Darden speech. Larry and I conceived Darden. Our expression was, he's a guy wearing his dad's clothes. And all these guys kept auditioning, and they kept doing these speeches, and they kept selling them. And it's like it's Inherit the Wind. It's this guy's like selling these courtroom speeches as I'm a winner. I'm gonna shove this speech down your throat, jurors. You better pay attention to me. And that's not Chris at all. And Sterling was the only guy who got this. And we were getting panicked. We were getting down to the production date, and everyone was locked down but Darden. We just could not find Darden. And they were talking about, we're going to open up a casting office in England and in South Africa. I was just like, what is happening here? There is no actor in America who can play this. It was insane. And then it turned out that Sterling was in the original group that auditioned like 5 months earlier. And then somebody like went back to that list. I remember watching that tape going, oh my God, he's it. Sterling was just magnificent.
I thought all the actors did a really, really good job. Travolta comes the closest, I think, to pushing it almost toward parody.
John was having fun. If I remember correctly, John's first day of shooting, it's Shapiro's introduction, was the him eating at Mr. Chow's, which is a show-busy restaurant in Beverly Hills. It's one of the few show-busy restaurants from the 90s that they haven't changed one thing. And John was just like this big, hammy introduction, and he started laughing. I said, what's the deal? He says, I think Shapiro is just like one of those showbiz guys.
So Brando came to me weeping. He said, my son is facing life in prison. Bob, can you help? So I'm busy, but it's Marlon. So I go to the DA and explain you cannot prove premeditation. Guns go off. Cut a deal. Everyone's happy. His son pled to manslaughter. He's out in 5.
Our original introductory scene, we gave Linnell a joke, which is we're going to the premiere of I Love Trouble. And she's very excited. I Love Trouble was this insanely overhyped bomb from 1994. So the timing was just like perfect. It was Julia Roberts and Nick Nolte in this big, expensive romantic comedy that you couldn't give away. And our original opening scene was Bob walking the red carpet at the premiere of I Love Trouble. You know, it's just like this ridiculous opening, but there's no reason to hire 1,000 extras for Bob Shapiro's introductory scene. So we made it a restaurant.
Why would OJ not have maybe worked if it was a two-hour film?
We would have gone into it the same because the tone of the two projects, it's the same tone. The crime, the craziness, the tragedy, the dark comedy, the social commentary, that's what I live for. OJ had so many moving parts and so many characters. To fit it into 2 hours, it just would have been the greatest hits. Because you gotta have the Bronco chase, you gotta have the glove. Once you get through the greatest hits, your 2 hours are over. When we sort of took a step back, we sort of felt that this story was a tragedy for everybody but Johnny. Johnny's agenda was LAPD has been mistreating blacks forever, and he wanted to get the word out. And the Furman tapes landed in Johnny's lap, and he got them played on TV, which was crazy because the jurors were not in the room when the tapes got played. So it was victory for Johnny. Johnny wanted to do was send a message to America. So it was victory for Johnny. For everybody else, their lives were shattered by the trial. Marsha, it was just a debacle. She left the DA's office. Chris left the DA's office. The Goldmans did not get justice. It was just terrible for everyone. But OJ got out. We didn't want it to be a victory for OJ. And so we had to design the show that OJ loses. This is one of the things I'm proudest of is we figured out the idea of his statue. And so we put the statue into episode one. And that big statue was in OJ's backyard. We didn't make that up. You know, again, this is just screenwriting tricks of the trade. You introduce that statue as this Roman god in episode one. And then you go to episode 10 and Cuba walks out into the yard and just looks up at that guy and he knows, I'm never going to be that guy again. We needed that ending for the audience to know, okay, OJ just lost. So I think that's how we made the ending satisfying.
You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Courtney Kemp created Power in 2014, marking her debut as a television creator and a showrunner. The series follows the complex character, James Ghost St. Patrick, as he struggles to balance his professional life while also being a major player in one of New York City's largest drug networks. Under her leadership, the series generated the largest concentration of African-American viewership of any scripted premium series in nearly a decade. Kemp spoke spoke with UT Austin professor S. Craig Watkins at Austin Film Festival in 2017. Clips of Power, courtesy of CBS Television Studios and Stars.
Our goal is the prosecution of one of the most notorious drug traffickers in our hemisphere.
We open up a nightclub to hide the money.
What if it could be more than that, though, man?
I just want it to stay this way.
I won't be a drug dealer forever, Tasha.
Everybody starts out small. Question is, what are you gonna make of yourself?
You don't just become a good guy, Jamie. You are always one inside.
How did the pieces to the puzzle of putting Power come together? So how did you meet 50 and what was that like?
Very quick version. There is no romantic story here about Power was birthed out of like a longstanding friendship between me and 50 Cent. He was at CAA, I was at CAA. They put us in a room together. That's why I say so much of it is being in, like trying to get in and work your way up. I was on The Good Wife at the time. My father had just died. I was trying to write about him a little bit. I was a new mom. I had already been working on something that was in a blaxploitation genre, which is actually funny because I just sold that idea. But at the time, I was working on that. And then they were like, well, 50 Cent and this producer, Mark Kenton, want to make a music-driven series. And I thought, okay. And I put some elements together and I got in a room with them. And then 50 and I, who I don't call 50 unless I'm in public, his name's Curtis. But Curtis and I just, we knew how to tell story the same way. Rappers and country music singers really just write stories and then perform them. So he was really already well-versed in beginning, middle, and end. And he trusted me to do, and this is the thing about all good bosses, they trust their people who already do what they do to do it. So if I have my production designer, I trust him when he says, I can't do that or I can do that. You know what? You trust people. He trusted me.
From your perspective, in terms of how you've invested in this particular project, what do you think the story is? I mean, what is it that you're trying to say through Power?
What I started out to say was really about Obama. What I started out to say was, here you get this really intelligent black man from the hood, and he, like most black people my age, thought that he could never be president, that the only way that he was going to get out of the hood was to, because he couldn't throw a ball, catch a ball, run, or rap, that he thought, okay, well, I'll sell drugs. So the whole original idea of the show does have a lot to do with the lie that he was actually wrong and that he could have done it legitimately and chose not to. So that was the beginning. But in terms of the characters having complexity and the world, what I always tell people is I'm covering the message of the show by showing you nudity and violence and all that things because I'm actually writing stuff that's very banal. The rule at Power is we tell a banal story and then we add power. So for example, we got a man who's cheating on his wife. That's like a story that you could tell anywhere. It just so happens that he's a drug dealer and the woman he's cheating with is a federal prosecutor and he doesn't know about it. And that's the first season.
Support for On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television, ranked a top 10 film school by USA Today and The Hollywood Reporter, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with Power creator and showrunner Courtney Kemp. For her work on the show, Kemp has been named one of the 50 most influential women in America and was named one of Ebony Magazine's Power 100 honorees. When we left off, Courtney Kemp was discussing the development of her hugely popular Starz series, Power.
What do you think it was about your approach of the pitch itself that Starz looked at and said, this is, we want to do this?
Oh, I'm not so sure how it had anything to do with me. 50 Cent was attached. And your auspices matter. I would say I went in with a very specific plan. I knew I was going to pitch characters. The most important thing in a television series is your characters. It is not your premise. As shows like The Event or any number of shows that were like big premise pilots can show you, a really great idea is no match for great characters. It doesn't matter what your characters do if they're great. People watched how many seasons of Friends? What did those people do, really? They drank coffee. You know what I mean? The Seinfeld people did nothing, like on purpose. Even in a drama, your characters are what people come back for. I always say that when you write a feature, all you're asking people to do is sit with those characters for 2.5 hours. When you are actually writing a series, you want those people to become a part of your family. And you want your audience to go, yeah, I can't wait to see what they're going to do this week. So you really have to spend your time on the characters and on the conflicts within the characters and then the conflicts between the characters. Within the character, him or her or non-gender specific self, and then between your characters. Otherwise, you don't have a foundation. When you go in to pitch to a network, the first thing they ask you about are the characters. They don't ask you about the plot. The plot is secondary. It's not as important.
Why you wouldn't have had us capped already? So until I got good answers to those questions, I gotta assume Lobos ain't involved. We'll compare notes after this meeting and see where we end up.
Right.
We're gonna find out who's f***ing with us.
You start with the characters because they have inherent conflicts in themselves. Like in each character, there's a conflict. So then you can always just service that conflict, right? So I make up more story about Ghost. Ghost is always, he's always struggling with the same thing. The same problem is always the same problem, whether he is shaving or driving or in a conversation with Stern or in a conversation with Tasha or in a conversation with Angela. It's always the same problem, which is, how do I see myself? Am I being a good guy or a bad guy in this moment? How can I justify my behavior? How can I justify my worst behavior? That's really it. That's him all the time. So as long as you're true to the thing in the character, you can tell infinite stories. Angela's always going to want to win. No matter what, she wants to win. It doesn't matter. Whatever we put in front of her, it's always going to be about, how do I win? Tasha is always going to be the same, which is, how do I survive? Which is not the same thing as, how do I win? It's always the same thing. Tommy's always, who will love me? It's always the same. So you can always make up infinite stories and put infinite situations around a person so that that question is forced and forced and forced and forced.
How could you take him back? I am his wife and the mother of his children. I never lost him. So whatever you think he did the other night, he was with me. You were a midlife crisis, Angela. Crisis over.
He's just cheating on his wife. It's super normal, and the reactions that everyone are having are the reactions people have. It's just heightened. And that's really the call of the writer's room, is like, how boring and basic can you make it? You know? This past season, we have twins on the show, and one twin is a good twin, and the other twin is a bad twin. And the bad twin does so many bad things that he ends up really harming the good twin. This is a story you could tell anywhere. It just so happens that we're talking about drug dealing and guns and violence and really bad undercover cops. So bad stuff happens, yeah. But that's Power. Yeah. But what is my weakness as a writer? I have many. That's why I have such a big writer's room, because I'm not that good. I'm not good at action, like putting action on the page. I'm good at cutting action, at editing it, but I'm not good at designing it. I'm not a good fight choreographer. That's something that I'm really learning how to do. So how do I overcome that? That's what a writing staff is for. You ask for help. When you don't know how to do something, you ask for help. You try not to get ego involved and say, oh, I'm the showrunner, so I should know how to do this. I don't know how to do everything. I know how to write a lot of different things. Like I'm a legal writer by trade. That's what my years and years and years were of writing legal drama. That's something that's very easy for me. Cop stuff is really easy for me. Intimate arguments between husbands and wives or romantic couples, really easy for me. Arguments between siblings, also easy for me. Writing some of the drug stuff is harder. Writing the action is harder for me. And so I ask for help.
Can you talk a bit about your writer's room? I mean, so for example, the makeup of the writer's room, what you look for in writers, how you manage the writer's room.
Sure. I look for people who are better than me. I want every writer on my staff to be a better writer than I am. I want them to know different things than I do. I don't have another Ivy League educated black woman from the Northeast in my writer's room. I don't need her. Mm-hmm. I have been asked many times to hire that woman, and I've always said, why do I need her? I need people who aren't like me. And that means any number of different people. My writer's room is diverse in the real sense of the word, like the actual sense of the word. I hate that that word now means black. Is the writer, people say now in Hollywood, they say, well, I've got a diverse director or I've got a diverse writer. You can't be diverse as one person. How is that possible? But that's what that word means. And it actually doesn't even mean like, it doesn't really expand to mean brown or Asian or native. It usually just means black. And that always makes me laugh. I've got a director named Lakeisha Washington. She's diverse. You don't say.
I smile in part, right, because when you, as you say that, I was, for some reason, I just started thinking of Sopranos, and I always thought that in many ways you could describe Sopranos that way, right? So we see the crime boss, we see the, you know, the big personality, but at his core, right, this is a father, this is a husband, and sort of grappling with that in the context of the show, I thought was a really interesting nuance and a way of thinking about the show itself.
I wouldn't be lying if I said I hadn't stolen anything from anywhere.
Absolutely. So one of the things I think that's become really interesting over the last few years or so is just the explosion of social media. Do you still live tweet when the show comes on?
Nope.
Nope. Okay. And there's this whole thing called Black Twitter and just a kind of distinct phenomenon in and of itself. And as someone who studies Black Twitter, realizing, right, that it's far more complex than most people tend to understand. But I know it doesn't write the show, but my sense is, right, that you and the network are responsive to the back channels and the chatter that happens via social media.
Well, it's changed since the beginning because I insisted in the first 2 years that I would live tweet every episode and that we would also have a Power Writers Room Twitter that would be live tweeting the episodes as well. And we started with that and we really wanted a social media presence that was going to be huge. And then it took off and it became something that was so out of control that I actually had to back off and go away because viewers did not understand that the show was fictional and had gotten to a point where they were threatening one of my actors because they did not realize she was coming to work and pretending to be someone. I was really saddened by that. And then misogyny, racism within the black community, and then some things that were regional that I didn't understand. For example, there's no real division between black folk and Puerto Ricans or Dominicans in New York City because everybody's everything. I just was like, forget it. I'm done. And the thing that's sad is that I no longer live tweet the show. So all those little tidbits about how we write the show, all this, they're not there because these people actually chased me off of Twitter. I was like, I'm not doing this anymore.
I'm curious, right? And I'm sure many of you are as well. You know, what have you learned and what do you think the network's learned about, you know, bringing together these diverse kinds of casts, telling stories from through different kinds of lens and how that might influence the kinds of stories that we might see in the future?
Starz really didn't have a kind of show because the current regime came in and all that was on the air was Spartacus. They had done Crash, which did have a diverse cast, but that was prior to this regime. Then this regime came on and they did Boss and Magic City. And then they were like, well, what are we going to do next? So they took a shot on Power because they wanted to see if they could get what they call an underserved audience to watch the network. And that really worked. All that that meant, and this is a very important thing, the only color that matters in Hollywood is green. Nothing else matters. If people are telling you that it matters that something is diverse or something is LGBT or something, it doesn't. Does it make money? Oh, it does? Fantastic. And so that's like really key is that my network, all they did was learn, oh, if we put stuff on that people of color will watch, they'll subscribe to the channel and we will make money. Anytime that there is like, there's sort of a, well, diversity is really happening in Hollywood and things. No. Ride Along made millions of dollars. Fast and Furious 6 and 7 made millions and millions of dollars. Power makes millions of dollars for my network. That's it. That's all that matters. That's it. That's the whole conversation. There's nothing else to say about how people's minds are opening. Nope. There's a network, I won't mention it, but there's a network right now that's looking for, they keep calling it the Heartland. And that is programming that is less diverse, let's just say. That's because that's going to make money. That's all that matters. Nobody cares. It's not like anybody's mind has changed. I think that's a really important point. I think people are sometimes looking for, like, you know, stories for people of color or women or people who are gay or people who are Native or people who are trans. They're finally actually accepting these stories. No, those stories are making money. That's it. Look at your ideas. Will your ideas make money? If your idea is not going to make money, stop pursuing it. Find the idea that will make money, go make the money, and then go back to the original idea, which will now make money because your name is on it. That's it. It's not more complicated. We are not, even though we are writers, we are also performing a service. We need an audience. Otherwise, we can stay home.
And so I get what you're saying, but I guess what I'm also interested in hearing you sort of speak to is to what extent, as audiences shift, right, as sensibilities shift, is that something that you think the industry becomes responsive to or has to become responsive to?
When they first started making Model Ts, they only came in black. But then over time, as the American car, you know, industry blew up, they started offering cars in different colors because there were different sensibilities. Nothing has changed. When Diana Ross and the Supremes were on the Ed Sullivan Show, everybody ran to the TV set who was of color. That is exactly what happened with Power. Years and years later, nothing has changed. That is my view. My view is not that they are understanding that there are different audiences. We were always there. What happened? Nothing happened. We were there. People of color and women have always been present. All that has happened is that a few of us sneaked in and then made some content. I don't see what the difference is between Power or Underground or Empire and The Cosby Show. Years prior, there's no difference. Nothing has changed. I really strongly believe that the things that have changed have been, we need to find some other way to make money. Power is a very successful show. It's the most successful show on the network, which gives me a little bit of wiggle room and weight to throw around. So my answers are less no and here's why now than they are no, guys, that's really not going to work. And they say, okay. But I only planned for the show to be around for 5 years. There's a lot of push from various people to do various things longer than that or different iterations. And I don't want to ruin my show by making it too long. It was not designed to be a show that went forever. It's not CSI. It's not a case of the week show. It's not a medical show. It doesn't have an engine like that. These characters are going to die eventually because that's the show. Did someone moan about that? Have you been watching the show? Okay. No, well, not everyone. It's not Hamlet. But I'm saying. But drug dealers end up one of two ways, and that is in the first two episodes. I state that if I were lying, then you would no longer believe in the show.
And I suspect, right, that many of you are thinking about writing for all kinds of platforms, right? Broadcast, cable, streaming, web. Just wondering about just your transition from broadcast to cable. Anything you might suggest to them in terms of those different platforms and how that might influence their approach to writing?
I guarantee no one in here is trying to write for broadcast. I don't think there's anybody. Can you show me your hand if you're trying to write a broadcast pilot? Good on you. You will be rich. The rest of them will be broke. The truth is there is absolutely no difference in terms of good storytelling or bad storytelling. I will tell you, broadcast is way harder because you have no sex and you have no violence and you have no cursing. And the bar is super low because I can show naked people at Power and I can show incredibly gratuitous violence if I feel like it, although we try not to make it gratuitous. And people will tune in for that. So your bar is higher. That said, if your show's successful, you will make bank, and the rest of these people will not. Netflix, for example, buys you out of your back end up front. So if you are so desperate to get a show on Netflix, if that's your dream, just know you ain't making no back end, no matter how big and successful it is. Like, those are things that are actually matter, because right now you guys are thinking about getting your show on the air. But the thing is, getting your show on the air is only getting your show on the air. Then you also are working so much as the showrunner, and you're so exhausted, and your family is not seeing you, or in my case, you get divorced. You lose so many things by pouring your entire life into this show. You better get something out of it. And so just, even though I know that's the goal is to get the show on the air and to have the career, I also want you guys to know that if you're looking at these streaming services and you're looking at this as like, oh, all I want to do is, you know, is get something on Hulu or get, you should think about the financial model. Our friend over here is very smart. You should be developing more than one idea. You should have a broadcast idea in your back pocket, because if you don't, I mean, just think about it. Everybody knows who Shonda Rhimes is. She didn't do that on premium cable, y'all. She did that on broadcast. So even though I know that it's very sexy and interesting to think of the streaming services and think about premium cable and all those things, if you don't have to write Game of Thrones, don't. Write something that will set your kids up. Because you can always go from that success to the smaller streaming. But in my case, the first thing that I did was after Power was sell a broadcast thing. That's the first thing I did. I told everyone that's my first goal because I want to be able to make sure I can send my kid to college. Power won't go on forever, but CSI will. When I started out at Bernie Mac, I didn't get along with everybody. Immediately, I realized that I was talking too much and that I was had too much personality. And I talked to my shrink at the time, who is still my shrink. And he said, well, you can do one of two things. You can learn to smooth that out, or you can be yourself and face the consequences of being yourself. And I chose to be myself and face the consequences, because that way I never had to pretend. And that way, every job that I got and every place that I was there because the people wanted this. I was able to run the writer's room at The Good Wife for a short period of time, the year that I was pregnant and I had the baby. I was running that writer's room because I had a strong personality. I was able to run my first show because I had a strong personality. I really like people and I like their stories. And the journalism thing made me someone who asks a lot of questions about people. So I'm actually, you know, I think it stood me in good stead. I don't fight with people, though. There's no fighting. If you're in a writer's room, you pitch something, it doesn't go. You pitch it a second time in a different way, it doesn't go. Then you're done. You don't pitch it a third time. You let it go. You go with what the room is going through. You go with the flow. Greg Berlanti said, and I think this is really important, he said to me, not to me, but to our whole writer's room, if you pitch something twice and it doesn't go, it's okay to be quiet about your contribution at that point. The key is to be kind to others and to be extremely vocal in your support of others. Use your voice for good, not for evil, but don't quiet your voice. I mean, that's the thing you got. That's all you got is your voice. So use it.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, as well as our associate producers, Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, Maya Perez, and Brian Ramos. Our production coordinator is Ava Mikes. Editing help from Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference in October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.